Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
From WBEZ Chicago, I'm Greta Johnson, and you are listening to the Nerdette Book Club. It's just like a normal book club, except you don't even have to feel bad if you didn't read the book. This month, we are talking about Lauren Ho's Last Tang Standing. There's a spoiler-free interview with Lauren in the feed, so if you haven't read the book yet and you are terrified of spoilers, that is a great episode for you to start. If you haven't read the book yet and you love spoilers, then you are totally in the right place because we are going to unpack it all. And here to unpack it with me is Nick Kwa. He writes about podcasts for New York Magazine, among other places, and he even hosts a podcast about podcasts. It's called Servant of Pod. Nick, hey!
Hello, hello.
I have to also say you are our first Dude Book Club panelist. So
oh,
welcome.
No way!
Yeah, man.
Exciting.
I had a feeling you'd be delighted by that.
I'm really deeply honored.
Okay, so I figure we should do like super quick synopsis and then we can dive deeper into the plot a little later. But for people who haven't read it, who haven't heard a lot about it, Last Tang Standing essentially is about a 30-something Malaysian woman living in Singapore. She's trying to figure out her love life, also, of course, while trying to get partner at the law firm, also while drinking a lot and playing like an insane amount of Candy Crush.
Relatable.
So partly why I picked this book is because it felt like sort of the perfect summer read, right? Like it's just so beachy. It's like just, you know, it's like there are some intense themes in it, but it's more or less just like a romp, you know? It's definitely a rom-com. Do you read a lot of romance novels, Nick?
I don't, but I consume a lot of rom-coms and television movies, like or largely movies. I'm actually a big fan of the genre.
Awesome.
And I'm a big sort of like easy read person as well.
Good. So the press materials, I feel like they went pretty hard on the idea that this book is sort of like a cross between Bridget Jones's Diary and Crazy Rich Asians. Did you read either of those? You probably watched them because they're both film adaptations too.
Yeah, I actually read Crazy Rich Asians and the second book in that trilogy. I don't think I've read the third one.
Okay.
But I did not read Bridget Jones's Diary. However, I'm a huge fan of the movie.
Yeah. Such a good movie.
Less so the sequels.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of the whole deal. I don't know. It's like, I feel like the two things I'm always complaining about is the first one is the best and the book is always better.
It's good to have a world view.
So we are also going to hear from some listeners. I actually want to start with a voicemail before we dive too intensely into the plot because I thought this one was great. This is from Michelle.
Hey, Nerdette. I loved, loved, loved Last Tang Standing. As an Asian American reader, it was even more meaningful to me, not just because it was hilarious and razor sharp, but because it put an Asian woman at the center of a story about trying to balance familial and cultural expectations with career and love life and just personal happiness. And Lauren Ho has brought a level of detail and specificity to the story that definitely resonated with me, and I'm sure even more so with readers in Malaysia and Singapore. And I hope that readers will come to this not just as Asian Bridget Jones, quote unquote, because Andrea's story is so much more than that. I loved it.
Yay. I'm so glad Michelle liked it. I think we should hear now from someone who is kind of on the other side of things. This is Allie.
Hey, Nerdette Book Club. It's Allie from Chicago. I read Last Tang Standing, and it was a fun read, but I thought it was really predictable, and I guess I don't really like books where the main character is kind of a mess. Also, I'm struggling to find critical discussion points to call in about, but glad to read along with you.
So, Nick, usually I save this question for the end, but I'm really curious, like, from the resounding meh that we got from Allie to the, like, I don't know how many loves Michelle had, like, where do you fall on that spectrum of this book?
Definitely more in a meh site. Yeah. Like, it's definitely one of those things where I like, you know, it was a fun enough read. And I think there's a lot of components about it that are interesting to me. So, you know, full disclosure here, I'm Malaysian. Like, I'm born and raised in Kuala Lumpur. Only moved here in 2008. So I've spent, you know, more than half my life back there. And So there's a lot about this book that was like, you know, it's interesting to see almost like a psychographic of of a certain kind of Malaysian. And, you know, for the most part, I think a lot of that kind of just cuts through and really rang true. Like, that's kind of how the worldview and sensibility looks like. But as from a plot and sort of a story perspective, yeah, pretty predictable. It is basically as built. It is basically Bridget Jones' Diary. It died down to the structure and the choices. And it's, you know, it's interesting from that perspective.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, like, I get the predictability thing. I feel like there are a lot of tropes in this book that don't come as particularly surprising. But, I mean, isn't that part of also what makes rom-coms so satisfying, is that you do know that, like, they're going to go through, there's like, there is a predictable formula, and you all end up in the same place in the end?
I think that's absolutely right. And also sort of thinking about this in relation to like that notion of rom-coms having a certain formula, you know, a three-act structure, and sort of the things that you derive pleasure from is, you know, it's the specificity of the setting, it's the character notes, the beat notes, like how interesting are these people, how much time do you want to spend with them? And I think, you know, primarily the narrative is a mess, and there is a certain kind of interest level to that, but you kind of want a little more friction, like a little bit more drama almost, and it's weirdly clean, like it's weirdly smooth for a story about a person who's a mess.
That's a really interesting point. Yeah, like she doesn't like get fired in a horrible way. She doesn't end up, like, I don't know, in like any super unsafe situations with anybody. Like, it all is pretty much fine, even though, like, I don't know, would you say she has a drinking problem?
I would characterize her as having a drinking problem. However, I feel like that such designations should be left to a professional.
Fair enough. Okay, so let's start from the beginning. This book opens where Andrea, who's our main character, who admittedly drinks a lot, but maybe it isn't problematic. We'll leave that to the professionals. She's like in the car with her cousin Linda, and they are both like decidedly 30 and single, and they are both scheming about lies to tell their family members about fake boyfriends before Chinese New Year.
Right. And I think it's also important to specify that, you know, she belongs to sort of this upwardly mobile Chinese class in Malaysia. Yeah. And, you know, having moved over to Singapore, that actually has a very specific connotation to that kind of life in which a Chinese person moves from Malaysia to Singapore for professional opportunity. And I think that to some extent it comes through in the book.
Because the idea essentially is that, like, Andrea is from more of a middle class background than even a lot of her family members who are living in Singapore, right?
That is suggested, yeah.
So at this party, Andrea finds out that her other cousin, Helen, is engaged. And I think this is essentially what the title Last Hang Standing comes from, because she had always used Helen as her, like, as her foil for, like, well, Helen is even older than I am, and she's super unmarried, so get off my back, family. It's all good. But Helen's engaged, and Andrea's shocked because she thought Helen was gay.
Yeah, which is, you know, also kind of an interesting line of conversation, which is, you know, I found that curious for some reason.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, like, there are a number of, I think a lot of readers had concerns with this book around, especially xenophobia, but there is some insensitivity around, like, body image stuff, I think. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, LGBTQ issues too, right? Because, like, I don't know. We actually got a voicemail about this. Maybe we should just listen to that and then we can talk
about
it.
Yes, go for it.
Hey, this is Liz from Roseville, Minnesota. And for the reasons I loved Bridget Jones's Diary, I loved this one too. I loved the, like, snarky humor in it. That being said, it was not my favorite book, and likely for reasons why I also didn't enjoy Crazy Rich Asians. I really wish there had been more fierce female friendships. Also, there was some instances when discussing LGBTQIAP relationships that I just wish were more socially acceptable. I understand that the book is about a culture that I am not familiar with, And also that, especially with older generations, it's still not necessarily accepted, but with the younger generations, I didn't really feel like it was modeled in the book in the way I really wish it was. So it was definitely a fun summer read, and I'm really looking forward to hearing the discussion and other perspectives on the books. So thanks so much.
So yeah, I feel like Liz did a pretty good job of explaining, because, and I probably wasn't clear about this, if you haven't read the book, Helen is engaged to a dude, and she finds, like, a very beautiful, very eligible guy who, like, is totally cool with the fact that she's a lesbian, but it's, you know, it's, I could see how it would be a bummer to read as a queer person, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, the context here, okay, so a couple of just caveats here. One, like, you know, I feel compelled to say that despite the fact that, like, I'm from Malaysia and I can provide context
totally,
here.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, I also want to preface that, like, it's my individual experience of Malaysian culture
absolutely.
As a participant
I
in
think
it.
That's really important, yeah. And I appreciate you specifying it. And I don't want to spend this whole time asking you to, like, explain all of the things in this book, just to be clear.
But it's funny because, like, I feel, and to take a couple of steps back away from the plot a little bit, I feel like this book is marketed primarily to the Western world. Like, there's something about it has a very sort of, like, a Western sensibility to it. Yet, interestingly, it's like really grounded in what is a fundamentally like a Malaysian kind of humor and worldview and an experience, which is such an interesting tension because her, you know, what can be sort of interpreted as her crudeness is actually pretty par for the course with the kind of humor and like sarcasm and snark that you'd get just in day-to-day conversation in Malaysia. And like as a people, not to overgeneralize, but it's also kind of true. Like we are extremely kind of just sarcastic people. again, not the overgeneralized. It's,
sure,
it's
sure,
just
sure.
what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the handling of the LGBTQ IA plus issue here is it's super curious because Malaysia is fundamentally, and Singapore, I should say, are fundamentally like conservative cultures.
Right.
Despite the fact that Singapore is modernized, it has progressed in many economic ways, there's still a very sort of like tight control over social policy and social sort of life. And so, you know, while there is sort of movement and while there is sort of freedom of, to some extent, freedom of expression within those identities, to a large part, the discourse around it has not progressed well, which is to say, like the discourse about it is very different compared to that in America and Western states.
That makes sense. Well, and I think, I don't know, the thing I found myself thinking about a lot with this book, especially even just going from the scene we just talked about at the Chinese New Year party to the next scene where Andrea gets a call from her mom and we find out how brutal her mother is. And, you know, it's sort of like, I think we're all at this point, unfortunately, familiar with the stereotype of the tiger mom. But I feel like this like takes that to like the nth degree. It's like an exponential increase of this woman just like harassing her daughter about why she's not married yet and what's wrong with her. And, you know, it really got me thinking that, like, a lot of what's really important is to realize that this isn't the story of all Malaysian people, right? And that, like, the more books that we have, the more we can have an understanding of, like, the nuances of any given culture. And, you know, like, it worried me to think about someone reading just Last Ting Standing and then being like, wow, Malaysian moms are the worst, you know? Because, like, that's problematic, too.
Yeah, I mean, again, sort of stereotypes being what they are kind of, like, grounded in sort of a very kernel, a small shard of truth. And directionally, yeah, there's, I mean, there's for a number of, like, broad cultural, economic, you know, those two things in relation to each other, reasons as to why there's a lot of this pressure, particularly among sort of this outwardly mobile younger generation to couple up and do all these things. You know, there are like very strong arguments already made that this is largely to do with, you know, independence, survival, that kind of thing.
Sure.
But yeah, I think, you know, the characterization of mother in particular is a cartoonish version of it, but it is directionally, at least true to the experience, I think. You know, I can only speak for my mother, and I can't even do that. But I would say that most of the mothers that I have interacted with growing up and from my friends and their mothers tend to be more passive-aggressive. This is aggressive-aggressive, so it's interesting to see it.
Well, that's a very important distinction. As someone who lives in the Midwest, I think that's...
You know, I actually would contend there's a lot of similarities between Midwestern nice and certain
hilarious.
Asians.
So So from there, we learn about Andrea's law firm, which is called Sing, Lowe, and Davidson. She's a mergers and acquisitions lawyer. We meet her arch nemesis, Suresh, who, I don't know. I mean, one thing I did love, which other listeners have mentioned too, is like, this book is very funny. And like, even in her initial descriptions of Suresh, she's like criticizing how he looks, but really they're all compliments, you know? It's like, it must be so annoying how much gunk gets stuck in those like super long, amazing eyelashes. Like, I don't know. I thought it was very funny and charming. And it's, again, to the predictability, like, it's probably not surprising to anyone that that's the guy who she ends up with in the end. But I do, you know, like, I enjoy the, like, nemesis to love of my life trajectory. We've seen it before. It's not the worst, you know.
It's a very potent sort of tension point, right? Like, it's, you know, the nemesis to romantic interest arc is, I think, grounded in, like, really strong emotion. And that's kind of, you know, it's kind of what you want. And I feel like, you know, we'll get to that later in the plot. But, like, the other option, I think, has far less kind of spark, you know?
Yes, yes.
And, you know, I think love is very close to hate in many ways.
Okay, so from there, let's see. I think a notable scene is that she goes out to drinks and she signs up for this app called Sponk, which I think is such a hilarious and absurd dating app name. And she meets this guy who she calls Millennial Orson, which we do actually have a voicemail from a listener who was really annoyed that she kept talking shit about millennials because Andrea technically is a millennial.
Self-hating millennials, as most millennials are.
Yeah, let's listen to what Rwanda says and then we'll keep going.
Hi, Nerdette. This is Rwanda. So I am about halfway through and am enjoying it. But it's not, to me, it's not like the propulsive storytelling, like, I guess, like Jasmine Guillory, where it's like, I feel like I can't put her books down. Like, I just want to keep reading. Like, this is one where it's like, I can pick it up, put it down, take it or leave it kind of story. I really like Suresh. I feel like he's the best written character. Andrea, I am kind of annoyed by her. And part of it is cause, like, so she's 33, I'm 31. Like, there are a lot of similarities, but she seems really kind of immature to me. Another thing that's been bothering me is just like how they talk about millennials in the book. Like, Andrea is a millennial. She is not old. And the same thing with Orson, like talking about him as like a millennial, like a derogatory term. Well, he's 23. Like, technically that's more in line with Gen Z. So yeah, I think that's just an editing thing, but also plays into how people, like broader society, perceives millennials as like a blanket term for anyone young. But that also kind of makes me wonder who the target audience for this book is. Is a 31-year-old the target audience? I don't know. Like, maybe it is an older woman that maybe doesn't know what a millennial technically is. But yeah, so that's where I'm at so far. Also, I really like Eric as well. I don't think she's going to end up with him. I think she'll end up with Suresh. But I like Eric. I feel like he's a good, like, spicy ad. So interested to see where it goes.
I mean, speaking of predictability, right? She's halfway through and she knows how it's going to end.
Well, you know, no, you, the choice to end up a rich person, you know, for some reason has been largely characterized as a negative outcome. But, you know, speaking as a person who's extremely pragmatic, if I was in your situation, I would totally go with the rich guy.
Would you?
Oh, I would.
All right. We'll get there when we get there. That's hilarious, though. I also love the, like, not all millennials thing, you know, where it's like, come on. Give us a break.
Yeah. Wait, okay, so what is the cutoff? I actually don't know this. Is it like 37?
I think it's 40 now. Or it's like almost 40.
Hmm.
So, yeah. Like, millennials are old people. But I don't know. Honestly, my whole thing about the generational labels is that, like, they shouldn't go in 20-year chunks anymore because technology is changing too quickly. Like,
1,000,000%. It's like a 2 to 3 year stretch. Like, the Gen Z plus 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 is
exactly
where we should be at this point.
It's just like they're, you know, we should start doing like Millennial 0.0, Millennial 0.2 or something, because there's just, we need better distinguishers than what we have. But anyway, Orson is much younger than she is, which she finds kind of hot and hilarious. They go on a couple dates, they hook up, and he takes a watch and gives her an STI.
Yeah, listen, who hasn't been swindled by a one-night stand? I mean,
I will trade you a watch for syphilis.
I will say, like, it's super. One thing that was gratifying is to see that happen. The notion of a one night stand, and it's so like, you know, it's not conventionally what you would expect from like an Asian story. You know, just like it's just so. Yeah, I mean, it's normalizing to an interesting extent, and it's funny because like I'm reading it and I'm like, you know, I'm clutching my pearls. I'm like, oh, in Malaysia, in Singapore, shit. And so it's really a really interesting thing to see.
That's funny. I mean, so do you think it counts as a one night stand? Because I mean, they went on several dates, which is the part that kind of surprised me about it, right? Like, it's a con more than like a.
Yeah, I mean, it's a con at the end of the day. But like, how does she view it? It's sort of, he's kind of like a what's the word? Like a boy toy?
Sure. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's only 2 years.
Yeah, she's not like taking it seriously in terms of like, this will be the love of my life now.
Yeah, yeah.
So she's determined to continue figuring out this dating thing. She gets invited to a super swanky book club, which I can't tell if that sounds like a terrifying book club or the most amazing, like where you have, it's like black tie book club. and she's, you know, kind of disgusted by the wealth at this house. And she ends up on the patio talking shit about it to this dude who she thinks is a caterer. And they like throw some poems back and forth at each other because they're both real smart, cool people. And it turns out the dude who she thought was the caterer, of course, owns the house and is super fucking loaded. And his name is Eric Dang.
Word.
Did that surprise you? That like exchange? Because that... I don't know. It's like almost a fun reveal, but it still felt not super surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic setup, right? Like,
yeah.
It's a very kind of you know, look at me, kind of slumming it out with the with the help, right? And it turns out that the help is actually the rich dude, and so there's also this interesting like assumptions about about class and its relatability and its romantic opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting, like. One thing that I did find sort of an interesting question that I don't think was particularly explored, nor I don't think it was in the interest of the book, was sort of what Andrea's relationship to her class was and what she thought about that. Because ultimately she sort of ends up in this place of like, you know, working to achieve partnership at that lawyer job. But we don't quite understand what the broader sort of worldview or ideals driving her choices, nor is there sort of any serious examination of that. But again... the qualifier this being that this is a, you know, beach read, but again, that might not actually be a good,
yeah,
a good, like, you know, but you know, it is what it is. So you shouldn't expect to do certain things. I don't know. I had a lot of interest in that topic of conversation and I don't think I got very much out of it.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that I feel like there was a little bit of that because by the time we get to the end, she does decide that partner is not for her, which And there is, and it's a very brief moment, but there is a moment when she's like, I have not actually been listening to myself and what I really want, which I thought was kind of nice because it seemed to me at least that like a lot of the whole partner thing was pressure, you know, whether familial or societal, that like she was supposed to be a super high performing person, you know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, she even has a conversation with Suresh kind of early on where she's talking about how in another universe she would have been a writer, you know? And we learn about how he's got this other creative thing going where he like does this comic book online that he's like kind of super ashamed of, even though people really love it, because it doesn't fit what his expectations are that he's grown up with in terms of what his success is supposed to be.
Yeah, which is again like another kind of a weirdly expected trope, you know? It's
yes.
like I think the sort of the superstructure here is that everybody deep down inside wants to be an artist, but you know, but we have to be lawyers.
But the world needs lawyers.
I also thought like the sort of trade of like references between her and Eric in the sort of before the reveal happens.
Oh
like,
yeah, the poetry.
Yeah, like you know what are our signifiers here? Ah, poetry. You know, artistic soul. You know, it's such a. I feel like we're scratching at something that is like so interesting about what is assumed to be authentically like good versus like you know something that's normal to something that's human. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I don't know. Like for better or for worse, poetry also has such connotations of like bouginess, right? Where it's like,
absolutely.
You know, like oh, look at this smart caterer. How lovely. You know.
Yeah, it's opera adjacent. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So from there, essentially, we end up in like a will they, won't they love triangle situation between Suresh, who is engaged, and Eric, who I kind of think of as like a sort of a Mr. Darcy character, right? Where like,
yeah.
And as you kind of hinted at earlier, like Eric essentially has the potential to become her benefactor. Like she doesn't have to, and he proposes to her and she says she'll think about it. But like, essentially, she would never have to lift a finger again if she married this dude because he is just like so exorbitantly wealthy.
Yeah. However, so if you kind of just do the interesting sort of moral choice waiting here, I think in the sort of like the pros cons like rubric for Eric, the way that she was making it, it's like instantly the sort of wealth is placed automatically in the con section, and it's almost independent of Eric's own like character formation of that wealth. You know what I'm saying? It's like she didn't reject him because of who he is. She rejected him because he's wealthy. That was kind of my sense of her choice. And I just found that really interesting.
I actually disagree a tiny bit about that.
Ooh.
And this is something I actually brought up with Lauren when I interviewed her, and we'll listen to the clip in just a second. But like my read on that was actually it wasn't because of his wealth, because you're right. Like in terms of his character, they got along beautifully, you know, like,
yeah,
he wasn't like, you know, some sketchy, I don't know, like oil magnate or somebody who like had exploited a bunch of people in order to get his wealth. Right. Like,
no, however, in the system of capitalism, anybody who's hyper rich is exploiting
somebody. That's a very, thank you for that qualification, Nick. I appreciate it.
Sorry.
No, you're not wrong. He's not explicitly exploitative, in which case he still seems, we're allowed to call him a good dude, even though you're totally right.
Right.
But I think the thing that, I don't think it's his wealth. I think it's that by marrying him, she completely would lose her agency. And I think there were a couple of really important moments where he didn't let her make choices that she should have been able to make for herself. You know, and there's even this one moment where like he's about to head off to Madrid for some conference or something, and he leaves tomorrow and he's like, you should come with. And she's like, dude, I've got a fucking job, you know? And
you know, you're absolutely right. I think I'll retract my assertion. I think that's actually, you're absolutely right. It's sort of that the notion of agency, I think, comes up more really at the second half of the book.
Totally.
I guess I was interested in what the chemistry was, because if you know, to sort of skip a couple of plot points, I don't really buy the chemistry between her and Suresh either.
I mean, I thought they built up the heat a little bit better with her and Suresh.
Walk me through that. So, do you want to keep going through the plot, and then I think we'll get to those points where I think the heat gets.
Yeah, I mean,
up.
Honestly, yeah. I think we're not that far. I was planning on just glossing over pretty much the rest of it, but. Right after the break, we are going to hear a little bit from Lauren Ho herself, and of course, we're going to keep chatting with Nick, and we got more voicemails too.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's listen to the agency thing, because I do think, and I think there's another great example of it, actually, when Andrea's mother gets sick and Eric comes in and just sort of like bowls everybody over and like flies in this fancy doctor. And Andrea's like, whoa, dude, like you didn't ask me about any of this. And I think I think he genuinely thinks he's doing the right thing. But I think, again, he just like doesn't register the fact that like she's not just like a little bird he found in his backyard that he needs to like nurse back to health, you know?
Right.
So yeah, let's listen to the spoilery question I asked Lauren when I had her with me. I feel like the old school version of this book might have had Andrea just choose Eric, right? Because he's very kind and super wealthy and obviously cares about her and he can take care of her, which those are great boxes to check. But I feel like this story really leaned into the fact that for Andrea, being taken care of like that also meant losing some of her agency, and that she seemed really turned off by that idea.
Yes.
And I was curious why you decided to make that choice in the story.
Well, there's this analogy that Linda gives. I can't really remember the exact wording of it. Something to do with settling up and using the whole, you know, do you want to get a degree in pharmacy versus medicine? I don't remember, but you think I would have memorized everything by now of the book because I read it like 500 times, you know, with yeah, so for me, I feel like you got it, basically. So she wants to keep her agency, right? I mean, she could definitely settle up, but it would mean that, you know, she's not being the feminist that she thinks she wants. She is, right? And I do believe that Andrea is a feminist, and I wanted her to be a feminist. And for a lot of people in this part of the world, being a feminist also takes into account and the kind of like environment they're in. So there are like traditions and cultural practices that they still have to, norms that they still have to adhere to. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that they're not being feminist. So basically, it's her taking back control of her life and taking the only decision she could take that makes sense within that narrative.
Okay.
It's such a wonderful thing to hear, like, a Malaysian Singaporean accent.
Oh,
I haven't heard it in a while. Other than my parents, I guess.
I love that. So what do you think, Nick? Are you still determined that if you were Andrea, you would settle up?
Okay. So I think two things. One, I think route it to the way that you phrased the question to her at the top of that clip.
Yeah.
Like sort of in an earlier version of this kind of story, she would end up with, or she would make the decision to.
Don't you think? Like it would be.
Yeah,
like
I think that's absolutely correct.
Happy, happily ever after, like beautiful ass wedding, nice babies, like the whole thing.
1,000,000%. And I think it's sort of like, it's sort of when is the older version? Like, what's the time period, right? Because I think the economic circumstances is, I think the part, this is the part that my brain kind of goes to, is sort of what is the context between making a choice for more agency within that context, right?
Sure.
Like, you know, we're currently living through a pandemic. Not to like bring this submarine into like like unfortunate place. Yeah. But we're living through a pandemic.
Minus 10 points for mentioning the pandemic.
we're going through a really hard time right now, which increased unemployment. And it's sort of like, the choice for agency is always like a choice towards risk. It's always a choice towards the great unknown. And it's sort of, I think it says something really interesting about the sort of economic context and place that the Andrea as a main character is, that she feels like she's able to want to do that and to do that in the way that, like, it says something about her relationship to what she thinks about society and how it's able to give her opportunities.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a sort of a Victorian England era version of this novel, right? Like, it's a very different set of risk and rewards. And I find that interesting. I find that within the context of like, how do I understand opportunities in Malaysia right now, especially for an educated, outwardly mobile woman who
right,
is
because she can pay her own way. You know, it's not like, and perhaps surprisingly, there wasn't a storyline in this book where, you know, all of a sudden her mother was destitute and she had to figure out how to help her pay off her debts or someone else in her family, you know, like she
Absolutely.
Can take care of herself. It's not like she actually needs gobs of money. It would be nice, right?
Right. And it's sort of, I mean, I guess, you know, in a way, this is sort of me speaking as a person formed by the fact that I'm an immigrant to America. And like, I have this sort of like scarcity mentality.
Sure.
The scene when Eric kind of shows up in a hospital and kind of like takes over.
Yeah.
The sort of like lizard part of my brain is like, oh, hell yeah. Like, I don't have to worry about going to debt. Let's go. Like, and so that's kind of like my visceral response to that scene.
That's so funny because, yeah, I feel like as a, you know, admittedly white lady, I was like, fuck this dude. Like, she already had a doctor. It was fine. He didn't need to come in here at all.
Totally, totally. However, I should say, I believe Malaysia has universal healthcare to a certain point.
Good point. Good point. So, okay, let's talk about Andrea and Suresh because there is one scene in particular that I remember as being like, pretty hot, which is, and nothing actually happens, but it's when they're sitting next to each other on the airplane. Do you remember that?
I do remember that scene. It's like that business trip over to Switzerland, I think, or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, who like, it's a completely relatable romantic situation, right? Sitting chastely next to the person of your maybe may or may not be affectionate desires. That, I mean, that's interesting, but it's also like grounded in the Wulde Wunde.
Yes.
The sort of like bloodlessness of that interaction. It's hot without being steamy, which is interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think you're totally right that it's that like unfulfilled desire that definitely seems to exist that we see a lot of in this book, as opposed to like actual payoff.
Right. And actual work, right? Like going into an actual relationship with either of these men requires some amount of agency giving and also certain amounts of reconstruction of one's identity, which I think, you know, I think by the end of the book, it emerges that one of the major themes is sort of her relationship to the world, what she wants to be, her identity. And so that is also an interesting component of it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because in a way, like, I wish there were more of that. Like, partly it was great talking to Lauren because I feel like even she sort of like breathed a little more life into that storyline just in talking with her.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's so risky because so often with a book like this, too, you might end up like, you know, two more pages of it and it might have felt totally heavy handed and obnoxious, you know?
Yeah, I feel like there is. And maybe this is a little too out there, but I feel like there is a way in which if you stage this book as a play, you might get actually a lot more like meat, because I think a lot of it comes through into like how this person moves through the world, because the format of a diary entry is very much a person interpreting themselves to themselves.
Yep.
And so you get a lot of, you know, just even in that clip that you played, like I think I got more of a better understanding about her character when there's sort of like a third party analysis done on her.
Yeah.
And I think people, you know, are largely mysteries in themselves. And I think that's a little bit of something that the format kind of prevents you from doing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because it is just, well, and I wonder too, actually, if like in some ways that facilitates us seeing her at her worst, right? Because she's honest with herself about like how weird it all is because nobody's judging.
Absolutely. And it also makes a really interesting assumption about a character, which is that she's able to do that. And that says something about her.
Yeah, totally. Let's listen to another voicemail. Here is Claire from Phoenix.
Hey, Internet. This is Claire from Phoenix, Arizona. I really liked the book. But the thing that I liked the most about it is that it really did a good job of talking about racism beyond just black and white. I've been having a lot of conversations with one of my friends who is Chinese, and she said that the conversations that are happening around the world have been really helpful about racism, but tend to only focus on black versus white. And I think that this book did a very good job of factoring in how you get different cultures and how they affect what everybody's doing in their life. And so I thought it was really great to see how, for example, Andrea's culture was different than Suresh's, and what that meant in terms of how they could potentially be in a relationship together. So I thought it was a really good book, and I'm super excited to hear the podcast.
I think the point about Andrea and Suresh is interesting because, yes, they're from different cultures, but it seems like they do share a lot of the same values. You know, like there's a fair amount of time spent with them, like in the office complaining about the idea of a glitzy wedding, for example, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I think being occupants of the same generation and the same professional class, right? Like it just builds more of a shareable foundation between those two characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's an interesting point that I think this book doesn't directly go, it mentions it, it goes into it, but it doesn't really explore it, the sort of racism that happens between the sort of multi-ethnicities within Malaysia and Singapore, particularly between Chinese and Malay, you know, and Indian, and that's not even to mention the sort of Aboriginal ethnicities that come out from those regions. And so, you know, I will say just as a matter of just discourse, racism in Malaysia and Singapore, it's handled and thought about and related to very differently than the way it is in America and Western states. It is more of a fact of life and it's more overt in many ways. Mm. You know, these days there are real progressive pushback into being a lot more thoughtful about race within our specific contexts.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially in the wake of the George Floyd protests and the Black Lives Matter movement, there has been sort of a transnational, largely younger sort of willingness to integrate, or not willingness, but it sparked this sort of, can we integrate that discourse into ours? How do we localize it? And you know, that is maybe more of a deeper reading than is warranted in the actual book. But it is, it as a product, this book as a sort of a cultural export, I'm sort of gratified as a Malaysian to hear that it's opening up some Americans to just like having a bit of awareness that racism is handled very differently in other parts of the world.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I think one, probably the most overt example of it in this book is actually Andrea's sister, Melissa, who ends up engaged, or her boyfriend early on is a Muslim man.
Mm-hmm.
And their mother won't speak to her because she's so upset about it.
Yeah, and I feel like that was by the end of the book, I think her mother actually gets the floor to sort of talk a little bit about why. And if I'm not mistaken, it's like had less to do with race a little bit. However, I think a little bit of cultural context here that's relevant is that in Malaysia, you know, Muslims are sort of the dominant ethnicity of power. And so there's like also a generational thing baked into that.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah, there's some antagonism classically between non-Malay races and ethnicities with Malay people.
So thank you for explaining so many dynamics. I didn't necessarily expect, or like, how should I frame this? I appreciate that you are sharing some of your experiences around it, because I think it's super interesting and I think it does provide some nuance to a book like this.
Yeah, this is a lot going on.
Is there, like, when was the last time you were back in Kuala Lumpur?
I was actually last back last February, March, around Lunar New Year.
Okay.
In 2019. I was supposed to be back in June, but you know, pandemic.
Yeah.
But it remains to be seen when I'm able to go back home again without you know, mortal threat.
Right. Knowing that this is not a perfect book, is there something that's just like nice about, I don't know, about reading about the place where you're from?
Oh, absolutely. I don't want to make it come across that I didn't appreciate this book. Like I derived a lot of pleasure from it in ways that I'm not so sure that it's naturally attributable to the plot. But you know, even
that's
the sort
a great
of
way of putting it.
Well, I'm trying to be very diplomatic. The pleasures of seeing something structured as a rom-com in a setting that's very familiar to me. It's pleasurable in the same way that, so there's this Netflix reality TV show called Singapore Social, which by all intents and purposes is not a good show, but I had a tremendous amount of pleasure watching it because I'm also just a big big consumer of reality television and that assortment of high quality trash.
Yeah.
I say that lovingly, very lovingly.
I love high quality trash.
It's sort of an interesting thing to think about this book in relationship to this sort of, you know, Crazy Rich Asians is the thing that gets evoked, right?
Yeah,
you can see the creature logic of the corporate structure here. Like, they like that. They will like something like this. Let's get more stuff like this going.
Yeah.
But one thing, and it's a completely unfair thing to compare Crazy Rich Asians to a book like this, even though they're occupying the same sort of genre area. But I think what Crazy Rich Asians really did was provide an internationalist perspective on this kind of Southeast Asian experience.
Mm-hmm.
However, this book reads to me more of a Southeast Asian perspective on something that felt international.
Interesting.
So they kind of worked in opposite directions for me.
That's really cool. It's funny because right as I finished this book, Kevin Kwan's new book, Sex and Vanity, came out.
Mm-hmm. Which is, my understanding is that it's more grounded into the sort of jet set elite.
It's very jet set. Yeah, a lot of it takes place in Italy and New York. It's kind of all over the place. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've seen criticism about Last King Standing as well, that it's just like so much exorbitant wealth, mm-hmm. and that gets a little eye-rolly. But I don't know. I mean, as a person, speaking of delicious trash, who just like loved Gossip Girl, like I am there for it, you know? Like, because there are just so many satisfying, ridiculous storylines. Like, yes, I would like the man sitting across the couch from me to be like, hey, do you want to go to Madrid tomorrow? Even if I have to say, fuck you, no, I have to work.
You're talking to the person who rigorously consumes the Architectural Digest Instagram feed. yes, there is pleasure in wealth, and it is such an interesting thing to grapple with. When a person like myself, who also grapples with like real populist tendencies, it's two parts. very, very irreconcilable impulses on my end, I think.
Yeah, I try not to think about it too hard because it's definitely problematic. But I don't know. I mean, it's just, I think part of it is just from a story point of view. Like, you can just, when there are no restraints on any of it, that's just, like, deeply satisfying, you know?
Yeah, if you just check all the politics at the door, there's a lot to work with here that's just the cultural politics of it. That's very, that's meaty. Bring back to the character for a little bit, like, what did you think of the way that the main character actually handled her choice? Because I'm still wondering about that sort of run to the end of the book, where, well, you just need to read a conclusion, so you need to drag to a certain choice. And I'm just sort of, like, curious as to how it could be done in a way that felt a little bit more true to character, because I didn't really buy it.
Which part specifically are you talking about? Are you talking about her deciding not to be a partner and quitting her job, or are you talking about her ending up at a silence retreat and Suresh magically showing up and her choosing him that way?
So I think, like, from my relationship to the logic of a character, quitting her job made perfect sense. It was consistent based on the events.
Yeah.
But necessarily making the choice, like, hey, maybe I should end up with Suresh, when part of her character sort of logic was, I really want to preserve my sense of agency. That took a leap that I kind of felt like could have ended better if it was more ambiguous. I don't know.
If it was more ambiguous, or I think, and I don't know if this would have been fun to read, but, like, I think it also would have tracked better with her character, as you say, if there had been more time between all of that stuff happening, you know, mm-hmm. like if she had called it off with Eric really clearly and quit her job and then, like, I don't know, found a job tutoring kids, or, you know, and, like, stopped drinking and kind of got some of those other pieces in place.
Yeah, I think the silent retreat is, like, shorthand for
and I think that's what wellness. And some time had passed also.
Yeah,
I think it was, like, several months at least. So I think it, they just sort of jumped to that. And I guess I don't think I was emotionally invested enough to be pissed, mm-hmm. you know.
That is, again, a very sort of diplomatic way to phrase it. but yeah, that was my relationship to the end as well. I kind of feel like I do this, you know, with books and mostly with television shows, is that even though I'm not emotionally invested, I'm like, what about the plot mechanics, though?
Oh, totally. Totally.
Yeah. And so it's just like, how could you ratchet this up to be 40% more interesting in the way it ended? And, like, I had a real... Like, the ending was just sort of like, it just ended. So
yeah, it's sort of like, well, that's nice. I would say this book certainly didn't blow my mind. But one thing that I did really appreciate about it is that I laughed out loud more than I often do reading a rom-com. You know, like, it was funny. And there's one line where, and I listened to the audiobook, and so I, like, distinctly remember exactly where I was walking down the street when I heard it and was like, this phrase must become part of my vernacular because it is so hilarious. And it was the line about how her heart did a kegel. And I just thought that was super funny and, like, weird. And I think maybe it speaks a little bit to what you were saying about Malaysian humor and, like it's raunchy, but it, like, you know exactly what that, well, I know exactly what that feels like. I just thought it was super funny.
Yeah, it is definitely, it has zingers. Like, it definitely,
you know?
Sparks. Yeah. It has this thing where the more sort of, like, relaxed, comfortable reads are ones where you feel like you're in discourse with the author, and you're in kind of, like, a really relaxed discourse.
Uh-huh.
And this kind of feels like that. Like, you're just hung out with somebody who had a lot of stories to tell you, and as a result, it's entertaining, even though you don't quite buy into the story itself.
Totally. Yeah, I think if anything, the part that I thought had more potential than we saw play out was actually the work storyline stuff, which I completely glossed over in our summaries. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we know that she's vying for partner against Suresh, but there's, you know, like, there's some drama with some companies. She ends up in Omaha at one point.
Yeah.
I think, and, like, the characters at work, I think one thing that I really appreciated about this book is that so much time is spent at work, because I feel like often one of my criticisms of a rom-com is that, like, a woman talks a lot about how much she loves her job, but you never actually see her doing it.
Yeah, everybody's a magazine editor. That's
exactly.
well compensated.
Yes, yeah.
And
I find that really frustrating, because especially as a person who, like, work is one of the more important things in her life, like, mm-hmm. you know, I spend a lot of time doing it. I think about it a lot. I would talk about it with a guy I was with, you know. But like the actual plot lines of the like company, the Nebraska, it's like, what is, why? You know, like I wished it had been more compelling still.
Yeah, that's actually such an interesting observation, because like you're absolutely right. There is this sort of balance between, there's a lot of pages spent on that work drama.
Yeah.
And so it does internalize the sense that it is an incredibly important part of her life. And that is something that like dominates her worldview and her thinking. But you're absolutely right. There's something I did not really track as to what,
right?
This,
like,
deal,
can you explain what actually happened with the companies and the thing and the?
And I say this as a person who, like, one of my favorite movies is Margin Call, which is like such a wonky how did a financial recession happen movie, and like I derive a tremendous amount of pleasure from that kind of stuff. And you're right. I would have loved to see more of that.
Yeah, like I just think it would have been fun to, I don't know, like turn up the volume on that a little bit, you know, because I think it's great. I wish there were more books that did spend that much time at work, just because like most of us spend most of our day, or at least in non-pandemic times, right? Like,
yeah,
the office drama is real, right? Like so many stories take place in that setting, but I just,
what
I
would you
loved
say
it more.
Is like a great workplace novel?
A great workplace novel. Oh no, you're putting me on the spot.
Oh. I ask and I don't have an answer myself, because like I would say like Severance or something, but it's not even a workplace. I mean, I guess it's kind of a workplace.
That's kind of a workplace novel. I don't know. I mean, I'm just going through what our latest book club choices have been. Actually, The Glass Hotel has some really great. That's about a Ponzi scheme. Yeah, did you read it?
Yeah, I did.
You know, like, and it's not entirely a workplace drama, but like the office chorus sections where like shit's going down and they're like they go to buy the shredder and all of it. Like I found that was my favorite section of that book.
I love that book. It balances the pleasure of opulence and watching that
yes.
world crumble.
Yeah, there's some resonant themes actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, this is way different, but another book club pick is Such a Fun Age, which is about a babysitter. And so, you know, it's not like a typical workplace, but it is very much about a young woman like doing her job and being very good at it, and also trying to navigate power dynamics, you know?
I gotta put that on my list.
Oh, you have to. It's so good.
And I'll also dock the book club episode away for later.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
None of it.
Tag it. Okay, so before I let you go, we always ask for like a clever rating system at the end based on the book. I couldn't actually think of one for this, unless it's like, should we do bottles of vodka?
Let's do bottles of vodka. So why not? Or
the
number
idea
of STIs delivered by a hookup. Like the number of watches stolen.
Yeah, number of watches is pretty good, actually. Weekly dose of antibiotics.
Yeah. That's 1 out of 7, actually.
So 5 bottles of vodka being the best, 0 bottles being the worst, a hangover being implied. How many bottles of vodka would you give this book, Nick?
2. I will 2. Say that I'm glad it exists. Yeah, I'm glad it exists.
Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm going to say 3, because I found it enjoyable. It was a great distraction during a really fucked up time in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it had some really interesting, I mean, like we just had like a pretty fascinating conversation about a lot of different things because of this book, which is
absolutely
cool.
Absolutely.
And I look forward to more from sort of this like time and place, you know, like I love to read a book that's not centered around white people and not even in the U.S. And I want more and more like it, so that there's less pressure on this one to be perfect, you know?
Absolutely. And specifically, I'm very interested to see what Lauren writes next. Like, where do you go from here, I think? And just having her being able to create stuff and put it out into the world, I think that's, I'm interested to see where her writing goes.
Yay! Well, Nick, thank you very much for reading a book you didn't love and talking about it with us. I appreciate it.
All things are worth talking about. All things should exist. That's, you know, everybody should make podcasts. Everybody should read books. That's my belief.
Wait, you really think everybody should make podcasts?
Let me rephrase. I think everything, if it has a chance to exist, it should exist.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. I think that is a much more diplomatic way of putting that.
Very good.
Nick, you are a delight. This was really fun.
I had such a good time. Thank you so much for bringing me on. And thanks for having me as your first
I was just going to say, dude, yeah, thanks for being the first dude. You did great.
But I'm glad to hear it.
Nick Kwa is so delightful. You can check out his podcast, Servant of Pod, wherever you get your pods. And also, I want to thank Michelle and Allie and Rwanda and Liz and Claire for the amazing voicemails. It is always so much fun to hear from reader listeners, so I really appreciate that you chimed in. Hope you enjoyed this month's book club. If you want to keep the conversation going, feel free to join us over on Goodreads. You can just search for Nerdette Book Club. We're going to announce our August pick on Monday, so be sure to follow us on Instagram for that announcement. We are at Nerdette Podcast, both on Insta and Twitter, actually. And if you want to sign up for our weekly newsletter, I think it's pretty fun. It's like a curated list of things to cook and read and watch and do, and it'll keep you up to date on all of Nerdette's episodes. You can get that at wbez.org/nerdetteaf. The show is produced by me along with Justin Bull, and our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak. Do your homework! Isn't that cool? Microphone sounds? Sorry. Okay, I'm going to go now, for real.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.